Welcome back to the Guns for Hire podcast. I'm Alia Brahimi, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. In this episode, we'll be taking a closer look at the inspiration behind this podcast series, the jaw-dropping build-up of mercenary forces in Libya over the last 5 years. We'll be joined by the experts in Libyan military affairs and my colleague here at the Council, Imadeddin Berdi. The story of mercenaries in Libya is so unwieldy, and from my perspective as both a scholar of international relations and a North African, so shocking that it's difficult to know where to begin. There's an image you can find easily online of a teddy bear which was left under the table of a family home in Tripoli. Attached to the cuddly toy's back is a mortar shell and plastic explosive, a booby trap clearly designed to lure in a child. According to the UN, these civilian neighborhoods in Tripoli were deliberately mined by Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group. The Russians had been invited into Libya by the warlord who controls the eastern part of the country, Khalifa Haftar. At the time, in 2019, Haftar was trying and failing to wrest control of Libya's capital city, Tripoli, from his rivals in western Libya. Armed groups from the west managed to hold back Haftar and his so-called Libyan National Army, sometimes referred to as the Libyan Arab Armed Forces, but the Russian contractors were adding too much value. Everything from target spotting, sniping, directing artillery fire, to flying fighter jets. Fearful and demoralized, the besieged Western side then turned to state-linked private military companies from Turkey. On top of all this, Russia and Turkey, who were also backing different sides in the Syrian civil war, they each recruited fighters from amongst the destitute Syrian population and flew them into Libya to fight on both sides of the front line. At the front, the Syrians joined thousands of mercenaries from sub-Saharan Africa who'd been selling their services to different sides in Libya's simmering conflict since the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011. Now, a ceasefire agreement was reached in October 2020, but up to 12,000 mercenaries remain in Libya, and there's currently no workable plan to get them out. And then there are the implications for stability in the region and beyond. Since 2011, mercenaries that were based in Libya have tipped northern Mali into civil war. They've killed the president of Chad. They've provided support and resupply to authoritarians and warlords in sub-Saharan Africa, and they've played a prominent role in Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Joining me to peer inside the mercenary maelstrom in Libya is Imadeddin Berdi. Imadeddin is a non-resident senior fellow with the Middle East programs here at the Council. He specializes in hybrid security structures, security sector reform, organized crime, and governance with a focus on Libya. Imadeddin has conducted regular field research in North Africa, primarily on avenues for reforming Libya's security institutions, armed violence, war economies, and cross-border crime. Imad recently completed an assignment as a military advisor for the UN fact-finding mission to Libya, and is currently consulting for the UN Department for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs. He's also a senior analyst at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime and a senior advisor for Libya at the Geneva Center for Security Sector Governance. Imad Berdi, it's my pleasure to welcome one of the Atlantic Council's own to the Guns for Hire podcast.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
Imad, you were born and raised in Tripoli, but you're joining us from Canada. Would you tell us a little bit about what brought you to Canada and why you left Libya?
Okay, well, I don't know if I left Libya per se, as I'm still following you up pretty closely. Sometimes it still feels like I'm still there. Well, I lived, I was born and raised, lived in Libya until 2018, did my master's SOAS in that year up until 2019, got a fellowship very briefly afterwards in Florence at the European University Institute. And I had plans to emigrate to Canada at the time. And I landed here 2 days before COVID forced border closure. So my small stay ended up being quite protracted. And I've been here since, basically. But I still travel very frequently back and forth.
And you're a well-respected analyst on Libya's military dimension. So very well placed to shed some light on our issue of the hour. Mercenary activity in Libya was pre-existing, but undoubtedly the tipping point was reached with the most recent outbreak of war in 2019, when there was a massive influx of foreign professional soldiers, creating a sort of outsourcing version of the security dilemma in a way. So my opponent has recourse to these hired guns, so I can't do without them. And then your opponent brings in more or starts using them in more controversial ways, so you adjust, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk us through that chain of events of how we've ended up with 12,000 plus mercenaries fighting and now supposedly maintaining stability in Libya, which I always find to be an extraordinary statement, but how did we get here?
Yeah, the story of mercenarism in Libya, I think, begins far before actually 2019. Obviously, the 2019 conflict was a sort of turning point in the level of internationalization of the conflict. But mercenary involvement in Libya, actually, its roots were in the revolution and almost since the Chad-Sudan sort of entente in the 2010 and the fall of Gaddafi, a lot of Chadian rebels and Sudanese then rebel groups thought to profit from lawlessness in Libya and set up bases where they would organize opposition to their respective sort of governments from. They stayed, a lot of these armed groups and rebels, etc., stayed in Libya, essentially becoming gradually mercenaries, pay for hire groups. Mm-hmm. And they were quite important at several turning points in that they were swing forces in a lot of the conflicts that happened from 2014 mm-hmm. onwards. They were overshadowed after the fact by the arrival of Turkey and Russia in the conflict of 2019 with Haftar launching his offensive on Tripoli. So yeah, the mercenary story begins a little bit before mm-hmm. 2019 in Libya.
Well, you say swing forces, but sometimes they even fought on both sides at different points, right?
Yeah, exactly. What I meant by swing forces is that in many cases, because they didn't have any loyalties and because mm-hmm. they had different types of battle experiences, mm-hmm. actually both parties sought to recruit them mm-hmm. for the respective kind of conflict. Obviously, the actor that sort of emerged as a top recruiter of mercenary and top financier was the Libyan National Army or Libyan Arab Armed Forces in Eastern Libya under Khalifa Haftar, under which most of the actual mercenaries that we have today from sub-Saharan Africa are under.
And where in the country are they now and what are they doing?
Their presence straddles a lot of central and southern Libya in particular. Ever since the Juba Agreement in Sudan, there's been a small number of armed groups that have returned, Darfurian rebels that have returned to Sudan, but obviously they still have bases in Libya. Mm-hmm. And their return wasn't really because of any coercive dynamic in Libya whereby any actor forced their return. It was actually almost, on the one hand, willingness, and on the second hand, as a result of funds drying up in the country. Because of stability in Libya, it was actually more alluring from a political standpoint for them to mm-hmm. return, particularly given political conditions in Sudan as well. That's for Sudanese groups, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. comprise the more significant numbers. For Chadian groups, I think when Chad popped in the headlines is when the FAC, Front d'Alternance and Concorde au Chad, launched its incursion into Chad that led to the, while not working actually, led to the death of President Deby mm-hmm. there and the takeover of his son. So you clearly see that, yeah, despite falling out of the headlines a lot and not being focused on, they actually have quite a substantial impact and have a ripple effect on countries south of the Libyan border.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of reliance upon these kind of informal fighters set the stage for the massive influx in 2018, 2019, where we had Russian, Turkish, and Syrian mercenaries coming in. But as you say, that was that sort of modus operandi was already ticking along at a low level. But we had this massive ramping up. So can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, so I won't bore you with the details of Turkish and Russian history of involvement in the Libyan conflict, but
feel free.
I think what maybe is important to note or sometimes underemphasize is the extent to which they leveraged actually their pre-existing security assistance or interventions mm-hmm. in Syria to then export that model and leverage it to deploy their fighters in Libya. So you clearly see that there was a whole ecosystem that was set up to almost export security assistance from Syria onto Libya. And in some cases, actually, a lot of the Syrian fighters on the at least on the Turkish that were deployed on the Turkish side were incentivized to going not just because of the monetary aspect of things, but because they wanted to fight Russia in Libya, and they wanted to fight Wagner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one interesting aspect. Now, mm-hmm. in terms of how things work in practice, they operated different models of recruitment. So for Russia, the sort of recruitment of Syrian fighters occurred in areas controlled by the state, whereby they used the Wagner Group, the Military Intelligence Service, etc. They offered fighters 3 to 6 months extendable contracts with mm-hmm. salary scales ranging between 1,000 to 3,000 USD, often unfortunately actually not met. So they didn't pay a lot of them the full amount. They gave them also exemptions for mandatory military service, compensations in case of injury, and even settlement processes for wanted individuals. So that's how they recruited both the personnel for the Wagner group and the recruits from Syria. They were then assembled in Syria.
Sorry, on that latter point, do you mean that there was a bargain struck with people that were wanted, almost like the criminal prisons model?
Yeah, exactly like what happened in Ukraine, although we didn't get as much attention as Ukraine, unfortunately, but the precedent was already...
Right, but that was already happening.
Yeah, there was already a precedent set there. And then they were shuttled from Syrian military bases to Libyan military bases, essentially either Al-Kharouba, more commonly known as Al-Khadim, or Benina International Airport in Libya via Damascus International Airport. Mm-hmm. So that's the model that Russia used.
And that was both a cause and an effect of Haftar's proximity to the Assad regime, and in particular, his son Saddam's kind of relationship with Maher al-Assad and the 4th Division, where they smuggle everything from Capsigan to human beings from Latakia to Benghazi. But those fighters are an overlooked yet major kind of exchange.
Yeah, I think a lot of the relationships that you outlined here with these sort of governing authorities of the Assad regime in Syria actually were rooted in that initial transaction. So I was ironically speaking to a friend yesterday about a second article, as we already touched on security assistance of Turkey and Syria in one article. But just to talk a little bit about how the principal agent sort of theory from an academic standpoint, and how the local proxies that Russia relied on in Syria and in Libya are actually now have their own political economy almost ongoing in the form of different involvements in the illicit realm. So you have Turkish companies that are now shuttling migrants from via Syria and via the UAE into Libya for then onward travel to Europe. That's one component of the illicit economy. You have drugs, obviously, that you've outlined, and there's even real estate deals and money laundering involved. So there's a wide pool of illicit activities that these two sort of networks that were brought together by Russia that they're now involved in.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And are those mercenaries, the Syrians that remain on both sides in Libya, that remain in the country, are they still being paid? Do you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of grievances over payments. On one of the issues, obviously, on the LNA side is actual availability of funds in particular, basically. So it's not exactly a huge money-making endeavor in terms of covering your baseline expenses for Wagner in terms of their involvement in Libya. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, on the Turkish side of the deployment, things work a little bit differently in that Turkey devolved almost recruitment to factions within the SNA there, the Syrian National so-called Army. And it was semi-formal
process of security assistance, whereby the Turkish state oversaw the process through Sadat, its own private, almost call it PMC or private security company.
Turkish PMC,
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the primary groups that it recruited amongst were Syrian. So the Sultan Murad division, the brigade, the Hamza division, and the Mu'tasim division. And so all of these were monitored by Sadat, and they carried out the recruitment at the headquarters of the SNA and then deployed those groups to Libya. And there the offers were a little bit different to the Russian ones. It was three month to 1 year contracts on rotations, and the monthly salaries were for 600 USDs. Mm-hmm. Now, ironically, again, you see this the political economy that I mentioned earlier. You have smugglers that are actually putting Syrians and pocketing a fee, putting Syrians on rotations to Libya in order for those Syrians to then depart to Europe. So there's a whole new political economy around migrant smuggling that is enabled almost by Turkish security assistance in Western Libya. So you have these two dynamics happening in East and the West, both facilitated by security assistance from Western Libya and Eastern Libya by Turkey and Russia, respectively. So it's almost amazing.
It is. The symmetry is extraordinary. But are you saying that they're using the mechanisms and the operational kind of like scaffolding that they're using to recruit mercenaries that is being geared towards migrant smuggling?
Yeah, essentially. There are migrant smuggling networks that are actually taking on a role in the recruitment of mercenaries, pocketing a fee from the salaries that these people are supposed to receive.
I see.
Sending them for free, obviously, to Libya, because the flight is to go to Libya is free.
Yeah.
And then from there, they actually are supposed to head to Europe afterwards.
I see.
And this is also done with the complicity of, obviously, Libyan networks as well, on both sides again.
Of course. Interesting. So we've talked, you've outlined a little bit the equivalence between East and West, and that they're both depending on mercenaries during the conflict and obviously doing other shadow things in the background using those networks. But doesn't this fact of equivalence sometimes obscure the qualitatively different roles of, say, the Turkish and Russian contractors on the ground and in the war in the final analysis? The role of mercenaries on both sides has been different, hasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely has been significantly different. I would say that on both sides, maybe the underemphasized role that Syrian mercenaries played actually was on the administrative and logistical side, notably on diluting language barriers. A lot of people forget that not a lot of Libyans speak Russian, not a lot of Libyans speak Turkish. And if you're jointly deployed at front lines, or if you're supposed to even coordinate, having a language barrier is quite a life and death problem in some cases. And obviously this was a bit less of a problem for the Russian side, because PMC Wagner deployed almost quasi-independently, didn't have a lot of direct relationships with, in terms of joint deployment, at least the front lines with the LAF brigade. Whereas for Syrian factions that were deployed as a ground force on the Turkish side, they were directly folded under specific units in Western Libya. And Turkey had cultivated direct relationships with individual commanders that it still has relationships with to this day. So there, they actually played the role on diluting those language barriers and helping in terms of joint coordination, etc. Mm-hmm. As Turkey sort of focused on establishing a sort of air defense bubble around Tripoli, build an offensive capacity with deploying the Sadat link trainers and some uniformed Turkish military officers and intel officers, etc., as well as technicians to Libya. And this was all partly to also facilitate the deployment of the Bayraktar drones. Mm-hmm. And then the Syrians played an important role in terms of being a expendable ground force. And it's, I think, a bit of a similar situation on not just the Syrians that were deployed by Russia, but also the fact that they deployed PMC Wagner. And it wasn't a formal intervention, because both Erdogan and Putin were very wary of public PR, I would say, damage that would result from losing uniformed personnel in Libya. Mm-hmm. So they both used expendable, let's call them, forces. Obviously, on this Turkish side, the Turkish trainers, etc., and uniformed personnel were not deployed to the front lines. Whereas on the Russian side, it was PMC Wagner, yes, but it's not official. It wasn't an official force, and Putin denied the involvement of the Russian state multiple times. So there were never any repercussions to speak of, even when Wagner personnel died in Libya. But in any case, there was, yeah, again, there were a bit, there were a few parallels there in terms of how mercenaries played the role and how they were used from a state, from both states' standpoint.
But the Wagner group forces essentially fought on the front lines, didn't they? Whereas Turkish nationals had more of a supporting training and technical role.
Yeah, exactly. So Syrian mercenaries on the then GNA side, the Government of National Accord side, were a vanguard force.
Yeah.
They compensated for kind of GNA aligned troops' human capital deficiencies because morale was quite low by the time Turkey intervened, and there were a lot of desertions, etc. Whereas on the Wagner group side, they also played the role of a vanguard force, but they didn't operate with the LAF. They almost operated quasi-independently as a force that sort of amplified the LAF's offensive capacity with precise mortar shelling, etc.
And so consequently, there's even a Wagner Group war crimes indictment that's been filed in Washington by the survivor of an alleged summary execution by Wagner Group troops themselves. That's well beyond kind of training and equipping. And the suit names Prigozhin and Haftar specifically. And I believe also they're being investigated for mining civilian areas. So they were very much on the front lines for Haftar, weren't they? Russian nationals.
Yeah, of course. So Russian nationals presented a qualitative kind of difference to Libyan fighters. First of all, they had more experience. Secondly, and I think this was also missed in a lot of cases, Russia is able to offer a qualitative difference to Haftar for one specific reason, which is a lot of the equipment that Haftar had was Soviet era.
Right.
One of the main kind of weapons used in Libya for advancing in terms of ground offensive and urban warfare is mortars. And there aren't a lot of people in Libya that are very proficient at the use of precise mortar shelling. So that's one of the kind of qualitative difference that Wagner played. The other, and I think this is illustrated, including in a BBC documentary, in terms of how Wagner positioned itself in Anzara and along Tripoli suburbs, is the sniping capabilities far outweighed anything that existed in Libya. I remember when the news broke through, I was then speaking to some of the people that were involved in the conflict, and they were like, we fought in different front lines from 2011. We even fought against IS in 2014. We've never seen this type of sniping capability from that far out. And therefore, that was already a sign that there was something was shifting around August, I believe, of 2019, which is when Wagner became involved in the conflict.
So they were in some ways a difference maker.
Yeah, they definitely were the difference maker. And had Turkey not intervened the way it did in, I believe it was January of 2020, they would definitely have broken through at least the Hutba Buslim area or Anzara front lines, which were the main kind of hot front lines at the time where they were deployed.
And Wagner Group forces flew MiG-29s and Sukhoi jets as well, didn't they? They provided an air capability that would have been lacking otherwise.
Yeah, so that's the other qualitative difference that Wagner deployed. I think some of them were actually deployed after the conflict, once Wagner wanted to entrench in Libya, effectively establish a deterrence capacity. And I think the deployment of the Sukhoi jets and in the MiGs in Jufra, etc., was partly played a role in actually almost buttressing the not just Wagner presence, but actually the control of the LNA over the Fazan, because the loss of kind of the Tripoli war and the military defeat effectively of Haftar in Tripoli played actually a role in exacerbating social tensions in eastern and southern Libya against the central command and against the Haftar family. This was essentially, they pitched this as a two-day blitzkrieg, a two-day offensive that would be very quickly won. And it wasn't the case. And for a lot of people in the South in particular, one of the main kind of deterrents against actually, let's say, rebelling against the Haftars was the newfound aerial capabilities provided through Wagner presence in Shufra.
Right. So they're performing an important function in times of war, but also in times of quote unquote peace for their proxy.
Yeah. So that's where, exactly. So that's why you get this almost oftentimes quote of, they're playing a stabilizing role or they're boosting stability, not realizing that this fictive or illusory stability in Libya is playing actually a role in feeding a lot of the conflicts and other theaters where Wagner, for instance, is using Libya effectively now as a logistical node for involvement and influence projection into other theaters. And over the past 3 years, you clearly see that if they're not directly involved, they often are involved after the fact in terms of making overtures to unstable regimes or areas where there have been governance disruptions or coups.
As you mentioned, before 2018, mercenaries were not unknown in Libya, and contract warfare was an established practice, albeit to a lesser degree, beginning with Gaddafi himself, actually. But I suppose one difference now with the current build-up is that the mercenaries in Libya currently serve a decidedly geopolitical function, as you've been describing.
Yeah, I think it's not so much as a geopolitical dimension. It's just that it's so far remote and agendas that are so far dissociated from the country. So before, you had mercenaries that still played the geopolitical role, but they were from neighboring countries. Mm-hmm. So you could see a direct link between what they were doing in Libya in terms of activities and goals. Whereas now a lot of the geopolitical calculus around what Turkish aligned mercenaries from Syria would do would be tethered to Turkish involvement in Syria or Turco-Russian relationship. It wasn't something that you needed to factor in before in terms of sub-Saharan African mercenaries. Yeah, maybe there were a lot of dynamics that kind of were affected by Chadian and Sudan's relations with Libya and Chadian and Sudanese bilateral relations. But now it's like you have to follow up on what Turkey and Russia's relationship status is to know or gauge what might be happening in Libya. And equally, you need to be familiar with all the other players involved, which, there are probably too many to name on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. But once you start looking into the financing as well and the potential for economic dividends by being there, it becomes even more complex, because the Wagner Group presence was initially funded by a third, fourth, fifth party state, wasn't it?
Yeah. So the Treasury Department, I think, been the initial wave of funding on the United Arab Emirates, although indirectly and in very diplomatic form. But in terms of contemporary funding, it doesn't appear that Libya is a money-making kind of endeavor for the Wagner Group, that they barely cover their base salaries, etc. It rather appears that, and this is also legitimated post facto by the recent kind of leaks about Putin and discussions, that the Russian state was effectively bankrolling Wagner's involvement. And so from that standpoint, it definitely looks like Wagner was not this exclusively private enterprise, but was a private enterprise with direct links to the state and also with almost subsidized model by the Russian defense and military apparatus for Russian geostrategic goals, which makes sense when looking at what the geopolitical kind of angle that you mentioned earlier. The difference between sub-Saharan African mercenaries and Wagner is that implicitly Wagner has the weight of the Russian state behind it, whether acknowledged or not acknowledged. So it has geopolitical implications, and they're dealt with very differently than Chadian or Sudanese mercenaries are dealt with in Libya, for example.
Yeah, and for the Kremlin, having that build-up in Libya is probably cheap at the price, really. Which leads me to my next question. Beyond the military dimension, what other activities is the Wagner Group engaged in Libya? And to those ends, can we see Libya as a sort of prize for the Wagner Group and indeed for the Kremlin, and one that it would want to hold on to, if stubbornly?
Yeah, so in terms of activities since the sort of war dwindled, the Wagner Group initially focused significantly, I would say, on stockpiling and transferring weaponry via Syria. So it dug these trenches on in Jofra air bases, entrenched there. They expanded into Libya's southern region of Fezzan, where they now hold like significant, what I would call informal influence. They built direct relationships with some of the commanders, both Saddam Haftar and other influential commanders within the Libyan National Army in the southern region of Fezzan that are deployed there. Mm-hmm. And they're also playing a part, I would say, informally in the succession planning that is currently happening in the Libyan Arab Armed Forces. So betting on the sort of best horse that they could find. I think in this case, it most likely is Saddam's son. Yeah, sorry, Haftar's son, Saddam. But they have a few other kind of wild cards that they also have cultivated relationships with. The other facet that they've also gotten involved in is training and building relationships with other factions. So you clearly see that they've engaged and trained with some Chadian rebel groups. FAC that I mentioned earlier, the Chadian mercenary outfit present in Libya. Yeah. They've also built relationships with Sudanese mercenary, Darfurian rebels in Libya. And this is documented by the UN panel of experts of Sudan as well. Mm-hmm. And they position themselves in the oil crescent. And this is all in addition to the logistical aspect that I mentioned earlier, which essentially revolves around controlling air bases in Libya and using them for logistical transfer of both human capital, essentially Wagner personnel, and weaponry from Libya to sub-Saharan Africa and vice versa. So they've used Libya essentially to amplify their influence into those theaters.
Yeah, so it's a major, Libya's a major platform for the Wagner Group slash the Kremlin's activities in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and it's definitely the Achilles heel in both U.S. and European policy, because what you clearly find is that on the European side, Libya is a file that is a little bit a point of friction between some of the major European players, notably France and Italy. Therefore, there's no agreement on countering Wagner there that is emerging across your European stakeholders. So you clearly always see that Libya is kind of singled out. You clearly see sanctions being imposed on actors in sub-Saharan Africa and networks in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing on the US side, but because of the kind of controversial relationship that the US appears to have with Khalifa Haftar, whereby they don't know how to balance out the kind of interest in keeping relationships open with Haftar and reconcile that with the goal of countering Wagner. So you find that their policy is a bit sometimes contradictory, if not ineffective, on both sides. And that's why Libya's the Achilles heel on that front.
I see. And for Libyans and for Libya itself, what do you think the dangers are of these entrenched mercenary interests and for Libya and its prospects for arriving at kind of democracy and stability? How significant is this mercenary presence for Libya's future?
Yeah, this is where I think the argument of stability definitely does not square with reality, basically, is that you cannot really hope that Libya will regain its sovereignty, that the arms embargo will be respected, that Libyans will be able to cast a vote knowing that the new government will be able to assert control over the entirety of its territory, while entertaining the idea that mercenaries serve a purpose in terms of preserving stability in the country. Mm-hmm. Unless there's an actual plan whereby these foreign forces, mercenaries, etc., would be gradually pulled out, I don't want to say ahead of a vote, but in sequencing that with the potential vote, I don't see that we'll get to a scenario whereby Libya is on the path to becoming a democracy. And I also don't necessarily see a path for that happening with free and fair elections, because what Wagner has shown a proclivity to tamper with suffrages across the board, I think he would really relish doing that in Libya as well.
That's an important point, because we know that Wagner has an advanced kind of political operations capability, and they've actually been busted trying to roll that out in Libya before.
Exactly. That was the initial impetus for Wagner's involvement, or some of the personnel linked to Wagner was for gauging kind of position on votes and potential potentially save Gaddafi's involvement therein, etc., with the two soldiers that were arrested that were linked to Wagner PMC and the Russian state, had having visited Zintan before to meet with Saif Gaddafi, essentially, back then. So it's ironic to see that argument about stability now.
And so you're saying that they're this kind of dark shadow in the background against which Libyans are just supposed to muddle along and try and arrive at a consensual, legitimate government. And that sort of, there's an element of cognitive dissonance.
There definitely is an element of cognitive dissonance, because I think sometimes what policymakers assume, particularly on the Russian side, is that, okay, if there's a government that's actually elected and tells the Russians to leave, they'll leave, not knowing that if actually the Russians are still there, that poses a threat to the freeness and fairness of the elections.
Right.
And the results, etc. So it's a very likely scenario that those elections will be contested, and that will provide the basis for mercenaries staying anyway on that basis. And that's even assuming that they would listen to an elected government and leave, which I don't think would happen in any case.
Yeah. I wonder if we can pivot slightly, and you could say a word about Niger and this pattern that's emerging near to Libya's borders of military hunters seizing power and now, almost as a matter of course, calling in and upon the Wagner group. I know that arguably the instability in the Sahel intensified with Libya and the collapse of the Gaddafi regime in 2011. It sort of began there. But as it comes back around, what does the fast spread of this model at its borders mean for Libya?
Yeah, so I think there's both a tangible or direct element here in terms of both what's happening in Sudan and what's happened in Niger. I think the main area that will be affected, or the main two areas that are already affected, is the triangle around Chad, Sudan, and Libya, or Cyrenaica. Kufra in particular is emerging as a sort of hub whereby fuel smuggling and weapons trafficking flows are flowing into Sudan to feed the fighting in Sudan. And then on the Niger side, the potential instability that would emerge there would affect the Salvador Pass, another kind of key smuggling route between Libya and Niger. So those are the two corridors from an illicit smuggling standpoint that will potentially be affected by the instability in those two theaters. But more broadly, I think that the point that is, or the precedent that is being set, is that governance in Africa is effectively, it's fine for it to be militarized. There's no longer this, coups are being entertained and European policymakers send contradictory messages based on which dictator they like or don't like, therefore weakening their credibility and their messaging about democracy. So for a lot of actors across Africa, and including in Libya, when they're looking at the sort of messaging of the commanders in Niger, etc., a lot of those are looking at the reactions. And in Europe, it might be worrying. The reaction may be worry, but on the African side, they're often met with praise because they're sending a nationalist message, pan-Africanist message, etc. So for a lot of people, there's an appeal there. And it's something that a lot of actors that aren't part of the sort of Western bloc are amplifying. So one of the main kind of actors that is amplifying this message on media is Sputnik on the Russian side. So you clearly see that all this is playing out, and the moral will not be lost on Libyan actors as well, which, well, in the context of a kind of rhetorical backing for elections, this isn't a great sort of precedent or ethos to have, basically, because for a lot of people, it's a lot easier to seize power through guns than to seize it through a ballot box. That's the message that is effectively crystallizing.
But actually, that was the original dream for Haftar, actually, all these years ago, was this model that's playing out. It's worked everywhere else. But unfortunately for him, he was stymied in Libya. And perhaps he's beginning to think that actually he's on the right side of history and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I think it doesn't seem like he suffered any meaningful repercussions for it, ironically. Yeah. Now he's sort of like he's being hosted and he's been rewarded for having an illicit migration kind of ecosystem built up in eastern Libya. And the reward is visits by European officials, etc. So you clearly see that from that standpoint, he hasn't become really a pariah that he was.
That's true.
Maybe expected.
So actually, yeah. In Libya, it's probably a warm message for the surrounding countries that you just hang in there and it will be normalized eventually, potentially.
Yeah, you can fail up. You can fail up in Libya. That's the message, I think. So,
finally, just to look forward, one of the headline ceasefire conditions in October 2020 was that all mercenaries and foreign fighters would leave Libyan territory within a period of 3 months. That deadline came and went without a whimper. And I wonder how Libyans feel about that, and also what you think can be done to break the impasse. Do we have to wait for a broader SSR strategy to materialize, which would be the moonshot approach at this point? And meanwhile, Libya bends and sways to the vagaries of broader geopolitical currents? Or what would you recommend as more realistic and impactful alternative?
I think what we would need is definitely at least a security sector reform process for both Western Libya and Eastern Libya. Hiding behind this chimera of unification of the military is not helpful, because the military and policing forces in Eastern, Western, and Southern Libya have drastically different issues. So therefore, assuming that unifying the military or a top-down solution exclusively will be a panacea to all those ills is honestly not a very productive approach. That's on the one hand from a security sector reform standpoint. But on the issue of mercenaries, I do think that equally and alongside this security sector reform plan, there needs to be two things. One is active mediation, because as you mentioned, mercenaries now have this geopolitical kind of dimension to their presence, which needs to be factored into mediation. So you need to talk to Turkey, you need to talk to Russia. You cannot expect that five commanders from each side that were fighting in 2020 will now be able to repatriate those. That's a ludicrous assessment of the situation. So there needs to be a discussion at the level of the international community, which, to be fair, I think is something that the previous SRSGs realized, particularly Ghassan Salama, who operated more at the international level towards the end of his tenure than at a local level, because he realized the geopolitical dimension that we're talking about. And from then, once you secure the buy-in of those states, there needs to be coercion leverage, both on Libyan actors hosting the mercenaries. You could also scrutinize the funding of the Central Bank of Libya to the different factions, both of the Central Bank itself, but of the associated entities to which funding is dispersed to. And that will allow you to make the funding dry up. That will desensitize mercenaries from having a presence in the country to begin with, because it'll be a losing enterprise, effectively. It doesn't really address the Russian angle, where we mentioned already that the state subsidized the presence, but at least then it makes the problem clearer, and it's clearer cut than leverage sanctions against individuals hosting them. And if they're cut off from supplies and funding, etc., that makes their presence very difficult to sustain. If they're cut off from catering, if they're not coordinating with Libyan actors, are worried to even talk to them, that makes it very difficult for them to sustain a presence very far from their original kind of countries and headquarters.
Well, like most of Libya's ills, drawing up the money seems to be a priority intervention.
Yeah, and it's ironically, I do think that it's easier than people think it is. Right. The fact that we are a rentier state and everything is flowing through sort of one entity effectively makes it a lot easier an entry point for policy making from that standpoint. Because if you're able to scrutinize things, because the state is centralized, then you're actually able to affect a lot more by dealing with one stakeholder or a couple of stakeholders than you having to deal with multiple ones. Now, obviously, this doesn't really address the fact that some payments are done lump sum. So you still equally need to scrutinize, for instance, Haftar's funding. You need to know where his funding is going, etc. And you also need to look at sub-chapters of spending, state contracts. There are a lot of ways through which these payments can be disguised. But I do think an entry point is definitely at the level of the political economy and the finance. And this applies both to armed groups in the country, but also to mercenaries. So you'd be hitting two birds with one stone.
I wonder if Russian mercenaries and Syrian mercenaries were to leave, would it create any kind of tidal wave within Libya that redisperses dynamics there, redisperses power? More specifically, do you think Haftar would suddenly become vulnerable to even a popular uprising? I don't mean just challenged by other armed groups, but from within his own power base, do you think he would become vulnerable if mercenaries were to depart?
I do think that he's definitely vulnerable without even that having been the case, let alone with that having been the case.
Yeah.
In many ways, Gaddafi had a far better system set up and he still was the victim of a popular uprising. Granted, with significant international support, but still, it was a popular uprising in any case. So I do think on Haftar's side, it's a bit of a similar kind of catch-22 situation in terms of the more he centralizes power, the more political opponents he makes, not just within traditional power centers that are opposed to Haftar, but even within his own sort of strongholds in eastern Libya and southern Libya, where I think stability there is largely predicated increasingly on oppression and repression than is a negotiated arrangement. When those relationships don't necessarily last very well, then once that Pandora box is opened, I do think the unraveling will be inevitably violent. So that's why I mentioned earlier that possibly a gradual repatriation of mercenaries is probably the best course, because you don't also want complete instability unfolding. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the argument is of mercenaries playing a stabilizing role is often used to kick the can down the road and not do anything about it. That's I think the contradiction that we're currently caught in.
Well, Ahmed, thank you for describing how you can fail up in Libya, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks again to you for listening. It's worth pointing out that in the last couple of weeks, the government in Chad bombed a military base in Libya used by the Chadian opposition group that Imad referred to, known as FACT. They've long fought as mercenaries in Libya, usually for Haftar. Meanwhile, fighting broke out in Tripoli between rival Libyan militia groups, killing 55 and leading to raised tensions across the capital. That's quite some stability. Like trust, respect, or reputation, the state monopoly on violence is easily lost, and so very difficult to regain. See you next month, and in the meantime, do get in touch with me if the fancy strikes. Goodbye.